Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. This time we begin the TICnet. I think this is going to be TICnet number something like 1,741. My goodness. All started back in 1982. So, that's what, 36 and a half years ago. A lot of water under the bridge since then. You can always go to two particular websites that will give you more information. One is amateurradio.tanglevictor, and that's the one run by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, which has the recording for the last 11 years, I think it is, maybe even more. From TICnet, choose the right year, month, and week, and you can play back past TICnet, so they all get recorded. Even all the things you say get done. Recorded down forever. Let me drop. One of the things we're going to be discussing tonight is an interesting astronaut pronouncement by Mae Jamison that was done recently. It was mentioned in Newsday in the April 3rd issue, Wednesday of Newsday. We'll be discussing that. Roy AC2GS has some very interesting subjects he'll be discussing tonight. Do remember that next week there will not be a TICnet. No TICnet next week due to unavailable of some of the personnel. Me, I won't be around for next week. So no TICnet next week. I was going to say, there's two websites you can go to. The other one is limonticnet.com. And both of those TICnets, both of those websites will give you further information about the TICnet. And Roy has a number of websites that he will be announcing where he gives you information, AC2GS. The TICnet, as you know, is broken up into roughly three sections. Let me drop. The first section is where we take sign-ins by people who do have a question or a comment for the net. And we take those in order, and we try to give people further information. The curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other the ins and outs, the secrets, the rules of thumb of wireless equipment, radio and ham radio in particular, the 27 or 28 different kinds of ham radio. People gather here and share that information. It's an educational process. Arguably, ham radio is one of the most educational hobbies you can find because the books and the classes make it a bit difficult to really find out how wireless equipment works. They get a hands-on experience of talking to other people who are doing it at the same time you're doing it and passing that information back and forth. It works extremely well. Let me drop. So those are questions and answers for people who sign into the TICnet during the first section. That's what takes place at that time. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS, with the science talk, and also the mailbag for anybody who mailed him a question because they didn't have the ability to get on the radio itself. If you don't yet have the right radio equipment, by way of Roy's website, you can pose questions to him that get answered. He has a live following of a chat room and also his website by which you can ask him questions on the spot. And I believe he doesn't lie. The third section is followed by Paul, WS2N, with the Space Report. And NASA's always doing some interesting things. And maybe that's at the time when we'll discuss this pronouncement by Mae Jamison. Just to give you a hint, Mae Jamison wants us to not think too small about just going to the moon or going to Mars. She wants us to think about going to the stars. And when you finally find out the extreme distance there is between every one of those stars, even the closest one, Alpha Centauri, you'll discover that the fastest speed you can get, and you aim yourself toward the best available rockets and using whiplash techniques with the planets as you go out there, using all those fastest techniques, it would take you 13,000 years to get to the nearest star, 4 light years away. So, traveling to the stars, even with a multi-generation spacecraft, I think is impossible. It's nice to think about it, but you got to get practical. And going to Mars is much more difficult, much more dangerous, and much more expensive. So it is my doubt that any of us within the...
Repeater, time out.
It's my doubt that anyone within the sound of my voice, not even your grandchildren, are going to see an astronaut standing on Mars. That's my belief. I might be wrong. Okay, at this time we're going to take check-ins. The people who do have a question or comment for the net, you're going to give me your call letters and name at this time. I'm going to assume that Joe DeVito, RYY, has already signed in because he's got a question every single week. He's a very inquisitive guy. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now. I mean, you do have a question or a comment. This is Dick, KTRIW, and we're listening.
And here we are, yes, Western Kai.
Sierra Yankee Lima, the name is Bill. He has with an announcement.
And WB2Q, G's Advil, yes.
Okay, we got Rich EO, Phil, SYL, who doubled with EO, so I missed the prefix, and Bill, QGZ. Number two, SYL, tell me your prefix, Phil, go ahead, to your call letters.
Phil, Bravo, India, Lima, Lima, KC2, SYL, Northeastern Queen, and I have an announcement and a reminder for the net listeners.
Okay, I got the Bill. Is it Whiskey Bravo 2, Sierra Yankee Lima? Is that your call letters, Bill?
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Yankee Lima. KC2, SYL.
Wow, I wasn't even close. Getting old. Okay, and QG's it. So we've got, I'm assuming I've got John. There we go, Joe, RYY, Rich EO, Bill, SYL, KC2, SYL, and QGZ, WB2, Bill. Anyone else assigned in the TechNet with a question or comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, if you're listening.
K2YW, this is King Bravo 2 Alpha Golf of Pop Echo Link. Follow up on that dipole. Have we relocated it? Dick, we spoke about maybe a month ago, and I have a little progress on that typo. Back in that.
Okay, give me those call letters again. Kilo Bravo 2 blank, and your name? Give me your call letters and name, sir, please.
King Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa, the handle John Juliet Ocean Hotel November. We're in Cape Coral, Florida, and there's a follow up about the typo I talked to you about.
Kilo Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa John in Florida with the dipole info. Very good. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. I'll give a quick call to Joe, see if he's got a question tonight. The B2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe, if you got a question. As you can tell, I made a guess, and maybe Joe is not there with a question. Rich N2EO, go right ahead with your question or comment. You got it there, Rich.
Okay, sir. M2EO. This is all my fault. I'm having trouble. Hold on. I had a lot of trouble last night doing what I can do normally. 10 minutes. I had to put two spade loads, one on each wire. Believe it or not, I had to work on it from 10 o'clock to midnight, worked out, I had a help from one of my aides carry me this morning, and we got it squared away. I was thinking that it might be good for the club to have aides, you know, people that are retired and pensioned to help people like me, and I'm sure there's others. Help. I know Andy helped me, Kirschenbaum, CEO. Hank, Whitey Wine, yeah. Both those guys were extremely helpful. I'd like to see you on our comment.
Okay, I guess Richie, KNB, our president, maybe should bring that up at a meeting. Let there be a formal group. Landmark has many individual groups, and a helpful group similar to what N1YDY, Hank, and Andy's great to CDO have done. Elmer's right-hand people group. We could, there's ways we can come up with a fancy name for it, but it's a good suggestion for those who have trouble doing individual things, establishing antennas and connections and troubleshooting equipment. It's a good suggestion. So the Spade Lugs, were they the ones going to the twin lead open wire to your antenna room? Rich and 2EO, K2IW.
Oh, they were just, had to go to my power supply to power everything in the shack. And obviously, when one of the leads broke, I was really upset about it because it wouldn't have been on the tech, that low band, nothing. Fortunately, at one of my age, now really into electronics, her name is Danielle, Dominican Republic. He gave me help. Doesn't know much electronics. But with him and me, we were able to get it done.
Yeah, very good, Rich. I missed the fact that this was your 12-volt power supply. And since many of our rigs these days all run on 12 volts, without 12 volts from your main shack power supply, all of your equipment is dead. I can see where you were at and why that's very troublesome. Because in your case, that ham radio equipment is one of your safety nets, one of your methods by which, if anything went wrong, you could holler Mayday. Okay, glad that was helpful with Danielle. So, yes, we should have a formal group of Elmers. And one more of the many groups within Limelock that can help people. Thank you for your suggestion. Now we're going to go over to Bill, KC2SYL. Go right ahead, Bill. K2IW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Evening, TechNet. Thank you, Dick. I just want to remind everyone that Limelock is undertaking a project with the Levittown Public Library to update the Levittown Public Library's collection on amateur radio. We're looking for donations to the library, which is on Blue Cross Lane in Levittown. Limelock Board has appropriated some funds for that, but if anyone has books that are in good condition on the general topic amateur radio, software-defined radio, SYL, or electronics, you may donate those at the library. I'm going to break a minute for the report. Okay, for the donations, you may bring them to the general meeting, which will be this coming Wednesday. We will collect them there. If you have books, they have to be in good condition. If they're aged, that's okay, because in general, in Nassau County, there are about 30-plus books on amateur radio. We would like to update the collection, and it would be in a general collection for anyone to take out. Through the Lexington Library and also the Nassau County Public System. If you have any questions, you can call me or you can email me at my call sign, Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Yankee Luna, at ARRL.net. If there are any questions, go ahead. Thank you, Dick.
Good suggestion, Bill. Let's see, is anyone that wants to talk to Bill right now directly? Because you know you've got a suggestion. You've got available books with reference to ham radio. So it's only books you're looking for, not hardware, if I understand correctly, Bill. And that makes some sense. The library doesn't collect hardware. They demonstrate hardware from time to time when ham radio groups give a presentation. But so books on ham radio, and I presume you're talking about Radio Amateur's Handbook, License Manual, manuals, ARRL books on antennas and the digital modes and so on. I presume that's the nature of the things you're looking for. Even if it's a few years old, it's in good condition. The Radio Amateur's Handbook for Radio Amateur, has got many names, we call it. The information in there, you'd be amazed how many people consider that an extremely good reference book. There are a number of electronic engineers at companies where I have visited or worked at where you will find a particular book on the shelf. Sometimes it's mounted backwards, so you can't see the spine of the book. And it's either the ARRL antenna book or the ARRL Radio Amateur's Handbook. Both of those contain so much information. You'd be amazed how many professional engineers are using those as reference books. Back to you for any further comments on this, Bill. KC2SYL, KQIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Vic, that's precisely correct. Any books on amateur radio or software-defined radio, shortwave listening is fine, and also radio scanning. There's a lot of members who are into that hobby of radio scanning, any kind of books on that, even though they're aged. Once again, as long as they're in good condition, the information there is valuable. The second phase of this will be going to the electronic magazine and electronic book portion of the project. But right now we're just focusing on the books on those subjects. Back to next.
Very good. And let me repeat something that I'll send back to Bill for a confirmation of what I'm saying. Many of the ARRL books, for instance, like the license manual. Well, license manual is not too good an example. The antenna book and the radio amateur handbook, for instance, get updated every... The handbook gets updated every single year. The antenna book, I think, every couple of years. Even though the one that you've got that's in good condition, you're willing to donate to the library, happens to be 2, 3, 5, 10 years old, doesn't mean it's not a valuable reference that could be donated to the library as long as it's in good shape. The Radio Amateur Handbook, if you read a copy of it 10 or 20 years old, at least the technical sections, the first few chapters, are extremely valuable, even though the later chapters on how to build particular equipment might be a little bit obsolete, you know, tube equipment as opposed to transistorized equipment. But still, despite the fact it may be a few years old, they still would make a very good donation. So rather than just throw them away or give them away, if you donate them to the Levittown Library, I'm pretty sure Bill and the effort that he's behind will definitely appreciate it. Let's see if Bill wants to give us a confirmation on some of the things I just speculated about. WB2. Correction. There we go. KC2SYL. K2LIW. Good, Bill.
Affirmative, Vic. That's correct. So Limewalk is seeding this project with money, obviously, and we're going to order from the ARRL, the Handbook for Radio Communications, the Antenna Book, Operating Manual, the various Ham Radio License Manuals, Understanding Basic Electronics, RFI Book, and book on your first high-frequency stations. But that doesn't exclude anyone from donating older books, because the more into circulation, someone is interested in that those subjects, they can actually take the book out. Look, the Limewalk Board has approved the budget for this small amount of money, but we'll get that to the library as soon as possible. And those will be the updated books, the most current ones. But as you would suggest, this was put up several years old, but the subject matter in there is still very back to that.
Very fine, Phil. Another question I was going to ask you, but it suddenly went out of my mind. If it comes back to me, I'll come back to you, Bill. Good luck with that project. Anyone have any further questions or comments for Bill on this book donation effort for the Levittown Library? If you have any further questions or comments, give me a call that is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, there being that, we'll go over to our next person who signed in. Mr. QGZ, the repeater QGZ. The big radio voice of Massapequa. And what's new and latest with you, Bill? And the information you gave me when I called you was very helpful. Although you'll find out at a later time when I talk to you, I'm still a little bit confused. I responded, I'm using, and man alive, what a learning curve for me. The reach of QGZ, K2IW Grand, Bill.
Hey, good evening, WB2QGZ. So, yeah, feel free to reach out, and if you have to do something else cooking, we'll get you squared away. So, you know, I'm kind of a noise fetishist, right? So, was fooling around, I don't know, a couple days ago. Something's making noise here that I have to smash. Let's say that. With a couple gas fed LNAs. It turns out we need one for an application, and I had a couple laying around, and I wasn't sure if they worked or not, so I just did a two-port game to see what they did. And then a buddy of mine built one based on the same device that is in an ARR preamp. So sort of the question is, I'm fairly confident that the maximum gain doesn't necessarily... I wonder if that was me. No, that wasn't me. Let me just drop anyway.
Your signal is coming through fine business, Bill, so if you're hearing something over your room, feedback, we're not hearing it over the air. You're clean.
Yeah, I have a couple things in the shack here that I thought I turned down that weren't down, so they were making noise. It was a little distracting. So I'm fairly confident that the spot that I have maximum gain when I'm matching my in and my out and doing any tuning that I'm doing is not necessarily the best noise figure performance. And I know that, talking to Chip Angle and dealing with some of his products over time, he eventually kind of said, listen, just put new devices in and hold your nose and move on, and that's going to give you 95% of the performance of something that I sit down on the bench and, use a noise figure meter on, I guess. So where I'm going is, without a noise figure meter, how can we properly evaluate as much as we can of all aspects of an LNA, LNA? And when we use a noise figure meter, what is it actually doing? What is it generating to give me a measurement? How does that kind of work? And that's it for me.
Yeah, good question, Bill. And this is a slightly controversial area. The theory of what's going on, various people have different ways of explaining it. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the guy from Bell Laboratories, who had a lot to say on this particular subject. The and that was not Reed, CQH, W2CQH, it was the other guy who worked at Home Dell. When you adjust the input impedance match, so you've got a tuning and a loading network on your input to your FET preamplifier, and you've got a tuning and loading network for the output, and you adjust for the highest possible throughput gain, you're very close to a good performance place. And so if your FET is capable of giving, let me give you a number, 0.2 dB of noise figure, by adjusting for maximum gain, I am going to guess on average you're going to get 0.8 dB of noise figure. Get that last 0.8 down to 0.2 dB of a noise figure. It's not the output circuit, it's the input circuit. The input circuit going to the gate is going to be mismatched in a characteristic way. When you've got all of the S parameters for the FET transistor plotted on a Smith chart, that gives you gain circles, and if the manufacturer, let me drop. The manufacturer has done a really thorough job on your particular GasFET preamplifier transistor, they'll give you a couple of other circles in red on the chart, indicating the location on the chart for the impedance that the transistor wants to see where it gives lower noise figure. You'll see an 0.8 degree dB circle and a 0.6 and a 0.4 and a 0.2, which will be a dot, so to speak. So if you get the most thorough data from your particular manufacturer of your FET transistor, he can predict ahead of time at your particular frequency region what impedance of mismatch it wants to see to give best noise figure. Turns out that the front end of a FET makes noise. The noise it makes is not at the best input impedance match. So it's a little bit spooky as to why the FET makes noise and why the noise it makes goes to a minimum when it sees a particular characteristic mismatch. Part of what's going on here is that when you use your, let me drop it. You set up your preamplifier under test, you connect it to a properly wired automatic noise figure indicator, and AIL Airborne Instruments Laboratory is the inventor of that technique. John Clark is the man I work for who invented that particular thing. Back in the old days, you would tweak the controls and by turning on and off a noise source, you would arrive at a measurement called the Y factor, a noise measurement for your particular preamplifier. And by a cut-and-try technique, you eventually found a good impedance match, a good noise figure match for your device. John invented this machine, which is an automatic noise figure indicator. And what it does is you would think when you get the best possible noise figure, you can look at the weakest possible signal. You could be adjusting a signal from a very weak signal generator going into your preamplifier, and you adjust the controls until the signal coming out has the highest possible signal-to-noise ratio of the weak signal going in. That would be a common-sense way of doing it. You do not do that for a number of reasons. Let me drop. A good preamplifier with a narrowband receiver after the preamplifier, looking at a weak signal from a signal generator going into the preamplifier, might have a signal threshold of, let me pick a number, minus 125, minus 130 dBm. No normal signal generator, when you adjust the dials on the front panel, can give you a signal of minus 125 and minus 130 dBm. The dial goes down to minus 100 or minus 110, and it doesn't go any further. To which you say, well, just put a pad in front and it'll go further. That's not the right way. The reason the dial doesn't go any further, even though the technique by which the piston attenuator works could easily give you a signal down to minus 150 dBm. The piston attenuator that you installed in the front end is capable of doing that. The dial doesn't let you go that far for a very good reason. Every good signal generator has got an oscillator inside, some amplifiers, and a shielded box for the oscillator, and an outer shielded cabinet for the hold-on signal generator. And the signal leaking out of the cabinet of the signal generator can easily be minus 105, minus 110 dBm. So the leakage signal coming off the case of the signal generator could be stronger than the signal coming out of the front port when you dial it to low signal levels. So that doesn't work. There's a slight way around that called the New England technique. You mount your signal generator in the backyard 150 feet away with a long piece of cable, and by remote control you take the signal that's leaking from the cabinet because it's so far away by inverse square law, you can make a weak signal measurement. But it's very difficult. Let me drop. So what John Clark realized is that you don't have to use a narrowband weak signal generator. You can use a weak noise generator. If you've got a noise generator that's broadband, and it's easy to make a solid-state noise generator that goes from 10 megacycles to 5 gigahertz, so to speak. It gives you almost the same amount of noise, dBm per megahertz, noise spectral, bandwidth's not the right word, noise power density. Each megacycle of bandwidth coming out of that noise generator, whether you're looking around 10 megs, 100 megs, 1,000 megs, or 5,000 megs, it's giving you the same amount of noise per bandwidth. So with a weak noise generator, that really is an infinite number of signal generators. By turning it on and off, and you've got it set for a rather weak signal, the equivalent of the minus 130 dBm, so to speak, as your preamplifier becomes lower and lower in noise figure, it becomes more and more sensitive to weak signals. And so the preamplifier doesn't have any intelligence. When you give it a pure sine wave signal out of the signal generator, it amplifies it. You give it a noisy signal out of a noise generator, it amplifies it. As far as the preamplifier is concerned, there's a voltage being presented at its input that's going up and down, and as long as it's within the right frequency region, the amplifier will amplify the noise. It doesn't know the difference between noise and signal. Noise and signal is just a human characteristic. We call a sine wave a signal, and noise we call noise, and we consider it undesirable most of the time. Let me drop. So what the automatic noise figure indicator does is it turns on that noise source, a very weak noise source, on and off something like 400 times per second with a square wave generator, a video generator, square wave, 400 times per second, 50% duty cycle. So for one of the 400 cycles, half of that cycle, it's got the noise generator turned on, and the other half has got the noise generator turned off. That pulse noise generator signal is going through is being injected into your preamplifier, and if you set it up just right, that noise generator is presenting exactly a 50 ohm impedance. It's usually something like a stronger, you know, a 30 dB TXS noise generator into a 20 dB pad, giving you a 36, giving you a plus 16. So because you're going through a very high quality 20 decibel or so 50 ohm attenuator after the noise generator, at the far end of that, you're getting the right noise power that you desire at exactly 50 ohms. You inject that into your preamplifier. Your preamplifier is amplifying this pulsed noise signal. And now, if the noise being generated by your preamplifier is very much louder than the noise from the generator, the output noise from the preamplifier will look almost steady. However, as your preamplifier becomes more and more sensitive, as its noise figure goes lower and lower, it starts seeing the weak pulses of noise, broadband noise, coming from your automatic noise figure indicator. So therefore, you've got a period of time when the noise is on, and your automatic noise figure indicator takes the signal being fed through, rectifies it, and stores it into a capacitor number one. Let me drop it. During the time the noise generator is turned off, it rectifies that signal coming out of your preamplifier and stores it in capacitor number two. Your noise figure meter indicator on the front panel is looking at the voltage between those two. And so, as you're adjusting the controls on your low noise amplifier so that you get a stronger and stronger pulse response, you're looking at more and more sensitive, weak noise source coming out of the noise generator, you get a bigger and bigger voltage between those two. It's a synchronous demodulator, those two capacitors. I'm calling it two capacitors just as a way of picturing what it does as far as a schematic diagram. It really is a synchronous demodulator. So the beauty of this thing is that because the noise source is so broadband, you can test a preamplifier that's running at 10 megs today and 1 gig tomorrow and another one running at 5 gigs tomorrow, the next day, connecting it to the exact same instrument. You'll have to change the receiver you use afterwards that picks up the noise coming out of the preamplifier and goes into the synchronous demodulator. But you don't have to have a zillion signal generators once you've got one of these noise sources. So John Clark invented this technique of the synchronous demodulator of a pulse noise source, 50% duty cycle. It does a beautiful job. Let me drop this. When you've got everything cooking just right, and you've got some variable controls on the impedance matching, usually on the input of your preamplifier, as you adjust those controls, you'll watch the meter on the automatic noise figure indicator indicating to you what is the apparent noise figure you're measuring at this instant of time. As you twist the controls, you see the needle going up and down in real time. You don't have to do that very tedious experiment that they used to do to measure Y factor step by step, which was very slow. It took you a day sometimes to optimize something. With an automatic noise figure indicator, you can optimize something within 60 seconds, so to speak. So as I said, John Clark wrote the patent on that. The model, I forget what they called it, model number one, automatic noise figure indicator, the Dugan truck we called it, was a product built by AIL back in roughly 1966 or so. Eventually, Hewlett-Packard came along with their particular product, which differs a little bit in the numbers it indicates. There's a half dB of difference between the noise figure you get from a Hewlett-Packard and the noise figure you get from an AIL automatic noise figure indicator. And all the experts for years were arguing as to which one is closer to the Bureau of Standards in accuracy. Minor difficulty, but that gives you a little bit of a thumbnail of how an automatic noise figure indicator works. I worked with John Clark. I did a lot of work with automatic noise figure indicators at AIL, the inventor of the product. And so I've got some exposure to that one, Bill. Fire away with your questions. I'm picturing myself in your shoes from what I just said, and I would only have partial understanding of all of this jazz. WB2QGZ, K2RIW, you got it, Bill.
Okay, WB2QGZ. No, actually, that was pretty thorough, and it gives me at least an understanding of what's cooking in that. In that noise.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
It's matching. Maybe to try to match one of those spots. Maybe we can fool with that a little bit. So for our use, we're probably just going to buy a commercial device. is, and next rev I think is going to be to incorporate some of the capacitive coupling into the semi-rigid, which is kind of trying to maintain that 50 ohms once we get on the board with the actual device. But that's good, man. That's good information for this week. How's that?
A preamplifier that you're building and experimenting with, Bill, is this done as an academic experiment? I suspect not. You're actually going to apply this to a good repeater or some other particular. You've got a place of application for the preamplifier, and therefore you'd like it to have ultimate noise figure. And by the way, to make a preamplifier have ultimate noise figure, high enough dynamic range that it doesn't get overloaded by strong local signals, you've got a number of conflicting interests there, conflicting requirements. In theory, you want the preamplifier to have a 10 or 15 dB of excess gain to make sure it overrides the noise figure of the stages that follow it of your receiver system. The receiver system is a cascading of a number of noise generators. The first stage is the most critical one, but you're getting some noise from the second and third stage of your receiver, which you'd like to override with the noise coming out of, with the signal being strong enough coming out of your preamplifier. Therefore, you'd like to have a lot of gain in the preamplifier. That's the first requirement. Let me drop. But if you make the preamplifier, and maybe the cascading of two amplifiers, higher and higher in gain, you rapidly come to the point where a strong local signal will create overload somewhere in the receiver system. So more gain gives you more overload. That's bad. More gain gives you better noise figure. That's good. Less gain gives you less overload. Less gain gives you a little bit more noise figure problem, a little less sensitivity. So there's a conflict of interest there. There's a trade-off. So where do you intend to adjust to use this preamplifier, Bill? And if it's being put into something like a repeater system, it's got to be extremely well shielded, because the strong signal coming out of your local transmitter, being coupled to the 12-volt B-plus wiring going to your preamplifier, can have a sneak path getting in there and give you grief. To meet your QGZ, keep your eyes having to check that. Wait for the beeps.
Yep, so I am kind of familiar with cascaded gain. I definitely have a grip on third order intercept. and again, we're probably going to use we're going to use a commercial device at least to start in the application that we need this preamp for. But the whole project of, hey, I have one, let me see how this one works, and it ended up being a little bit out of band. It's a VHF application. The AR I had was an SP model number. It set it up about 165 megahertz, so gain is down about the 3 dB points. It works about 150 to about 175. Down at 146, it's I want to say gain is down about 6 dB, 4 dB for max. But it kind of turned into an academic project, just to see what we can. What we can do. I understand the challenge of making it robust enough to leave on its own in a cabinet someplace and expect it not to become a mixer.
Yeah, one piece of good news that I discovered, Bill, is that sometimes you can use your preamplifier very far out of the frequency range it was tuned to. Your preamplifier may be tuned to, let me pick a number, 155 megahertz, and 144 megahertz, it's, let's say, 6 dB down in gain. And let's assume the gain was 20 dB, close to 20 dB at the 155 meg, and so now it's down to 14 dB of gain at 146. It could still be presenting a very good noise figure at the 14 dB of gain. When a preamplifier, with this tuning of its output stage, is giving you extra loss because you're out of band, the noise figure can still be extremely good down at your frequency. Only if you're getting a whole lot of excess insertion loss of the input impedance matching network, that will add to your noise figure. But as long as the input is somewhat tuned and the output is peaked somewhere else, you can still be getting some very desirable characteristics out of band, so to speak. So now, you have access to some very good test equipment, though, and you've got a whole lot of friends. Guaranteed there is somebody that can loan you or rent you an automatic noise figure indicator. You have ways of getting a hold of one. If you really want to see what's happening in real time with fast answers, do get by, beg or borrow or steal an automatic noise figure indicator. Choose the right brand name and learn how to use it, and they will do magic. I would give that some strong thought, Bill. Have you reached your QGZ? K2LIW in the tech net.
But, you know, that's not a bad idea because WB2QGZ, there are a couple of people whose arms I could twist. And that's that. Maybe I'll do that once we get to the next rev here in this project. I only started talking about this. I didn't realize that my buddy was building one there until we talked about it on Saturday, and that's where all of this kind of came up in the meantime. And yeah, see the pants. That 160 megahertz device does still work pretty well. It makes a noticeable difference at 144 megahertz. And the gain is down, so it's something like about 24 dB gain peak at the center of the sweet spot where it's tuned, and I'm down about 21, 22 at 144 megahertz. So it's not bad, and it would probably work if push came to shove. The devices are relatively inexpensive, so as we're putting this in a place that we want to put it and leave it and never go back to, or never have to go back to. We'll probably spend $100 and buy one from ARR. I don't think there's any more Angolinears available, which is a shame because they're built much more physically robustly. But maybe for the next rev, I'll see if I can get a noise figure meter and see what it tells us. It'd be a fun experiment. WB2QGZ.
Yeah, that ham radio operator near Los Angeles, Angolinear. In California, he had a beautiful product. He's no longer in business. Is that what you're saying, Bill?
Not 100% sure, but I was under the impression he was looking to retire. And then last time I tried to order something, I mentioned to somebody else, "Hey, I'm looking for a couple of the Angolinear LNAs." And I was told that he had stopped making them. Now it's possible that somebody took his design and kept building them. He was pretty good when it came to working with ham, so if you called him up on the phone, and sometimes he was a little temperamental, and if you didn't have what he felt was sufficient filtering in front of your LNA, he wouldn't sell it to you. But he would really play Let's Make a Deal. Now, you might have to wait 3 weeks to get one, but he would really work with hams and give you excellent pricing. That same device that he would sell for anywhere between $79 and $129 to a ham was like $400 in a Tesco catalog to a commercial person. So, that was kind of nice while it lasted.
WA2CDL with information.
Andy recognized Angolinear was Chip Angle in the Los Angeles area. Before we go over to Andy, what was his call letters, Bill? Angolinear, Chip Angle.
And maybe Andy knows, I don't remember. I thought it was a 1x2 N6 call, but I'm not 100% sure. It could have been Charlie Alpha. I'm not sure, though.
N6CA. That could be it. That sounds like it. The B2CDL with some information. Go right ahead, Andy.
All right. Well, you guys perked up my ears. Listening in, as I usually do. Say hello. I believe it's, I thought it was W6CA. I know it's his initials, Chip Angle. Actually, I have a few of his amplifiers made by him. But, Bill, this may give you the opportunity for you to come over here and we can play. Because I happen to have what Dick is talking about as far as noise figure meters. I have the HT8903B with all the documentation, including information that Dick is talking about and how it's designed and what it does. And I have brand new noise sources for it. And I also have an AIL one as well, just the one that Dick mentioned. I have both. So, anytime you want to play, you could, welcome to do so, instead of spending a fortune. They'll give us both the opportunity to figure things out. What do you think of that? Dick, over to you.
Go right ahead, Bill.
That's pretty cool. Thanks for the offer. It's very generous. And I absolutely will. So, when we're at, again, the next revision here, which is moving a couple things around on the board and making it a little bit smaller, I will definitely get a hold of you. We'll set up a rendezvous. Perfect.
Okay. And it also leads me into not a big discussion, but more of kind of wondering what's happening over at the airfield. If you recall, I think you were there too. I haven't heard anything from them if they still have the problem. But, you know, not to take away anything from the TechNet, but maybe we'll talk about that too, because I did tell them a few months ago, one of the guys was here at the house, and because he loaned me one of the controllers, but of course I couldn't do much with it. I just wanted to see, you know, how it works, get an idea. Anyway, so we can talk about that. Because I feel like we, in my opinion, I sort of left them hanging, what's going on, and if they still have the problem, if we can help them, and also some other issues that came up. So I just thought I'd mention that since I got you, Bill. And then we can go on a transmitter hunt also at the same time, which we've gone on. Okay, that's it. Big thanks to you, and thanks for the time. And I'm finishing up a job here. I have to go to work tomorrow. HRIW, WHCDL. Back to you.
We're going to turn it back over to Bill, QGZ, for any further comments about the electronic noise, we're talking about now. The undesired noise at the airfield. Over to you, Bill, for any further comments on that one.
Hi, WB2QGZ. Yeah, Andy, not much further. I might have had one or email correspondence with those folks since they were all over there. And we pretty much ruled out, as near as I can tell, the local cell site over there. You know, I think the plan was to try to do some remote monitoring, and they were going to try to get some kind of internet down there. But even that's kind of challenging, because part of them getting internet down there was going to involve, you know, emissions in that same band they were really trying to monitor. You know, and they were still a little up on there. There's got to be a microwave path shooting over the field, and when you look at the surrounding area, realize the amount of power that would have to be there. You know, it would be something you would see. In other words, nobody's shooting a 2.4 gig license-free path over that field from 6 miles east to 6 miles west, right? If there was going to be something there shooting over the field, you would see two dishes shooting over the field. So not sure where they're at. The other thing was, it seemed like there was another method of control. One of the things we were hunting down. Let me drop. Was the fact that particular controller and the method of PCM they used, or it was more the way it they spread and the way it recovered when it lost lock. That might have been the problem all along, the modulation scheme and the control scheme, more than, in other words, there might have been systems that were more resilient to interference, and being that this one was more susceptible, it gave them more trouble. And that's about it. That's where we kind of left it. Dick?
Very fine. Just thought of some one thing I should have mentioned earlier. I'm going back a subject now, the automatic noise figure indicator. The method of operation of an automatic noise figure indicator, where you've got a synchronous detector on the output looking at the ratio between noise on and noise off, when the noise generator is turned on and turned off, and it's looking at that ratio. that is using radiometry techniques. That's the technique that's being used by a radio telescope. The noise coming off the star when you are aiming your radio telescope at a particular star, that noise might be 10 or 20 dB weaker than the noise being generated by your own low noise front end on your radio telescope connected to your dish that aims at that star. And so, under normal circumstances, you'd say, hey, the signal we're looking for, the noise from the star, is 10 or 20 dB weaker than the noise of my total radio telescope receiver system. I can't measure it. You absolutely can. You absolutely can. As long as you can have a so-called Dickey switch, in other words, you've got a correctional switch. Let me drop this. You got a coaxial switch in the front end of your radio telescope that flips between the antenna looking at the star and periodically 400 times per second flips over and looks at a dummy noise source. And in some cases you adjust the temperature of the dummy noise source to adjust its noise power output to either equal or measure the difference between the star noise and the dummy noise. But even though the signal is 10 dB weaker. A 10 dB weaker signal, for instance, when you add it to the noise of your system, on and off, the noise coming out changes by, let me pick a number, 2/10 of a dB. As long as you've got a big enough integrator, wide bandwidth of noise going in, narrow video bandwidth of what you detect coming back out, measuring something 20 and 30 dB weaker than the noise of your receiver system is easy by radiometry techniques. You're looking for small changes, and because you're flipping back and forth 400 times per second, any gain change of the receiver itself can't change that fast, and it wouldn't do it synchronously. It wouldn't do it exactly 400 times per second that you're flipping the relay, so it would not correlate. So the system can become extremely weak signal sensitive. You can look at signals, as I said, as much as 30 dB weaker than the noise of your own receiver system. An automatic noise figure indicator is using that. It's not flipping between a radio telescope looking at the star and looking at a dummy load. It's looking at noise on and noise off. It's looking at the ratio in either case. But it's looking at a weak signal buried in the noise, synchronously demodulating that, and looking for that weak square wave, synchronous video coming back out, and measuring its amplitude, and interpreting that into noise figure once you know the exact magnitude of the noise coming out of your noise source. Does that make a little more sense, Bill?
Repeater, timeout.
Just timed it out. WB2GZ, K2RIW in the tech man.
It does. And that makes sense. So what's the method used to calibrate this device then? Do we have a standard noise figure device that we can plug in and make sure it reads what we're supposed to, or how does that work?
Funny you should ask. The very next product that John Clark came out with was a specific noise generator calibration system by a mysterious process of taking a receiver system of known noise figure. You got a bootstrapping operation going on here. You got to know the noise figure of the receiver system that's doing the testing. But by flipping back and forth between the unknown noise source and a known 50 ohm load, you can find out how noisy, how strong is the signal from your noise source. Again, you're looking at ratios, radiometry techniques. The amount of noise power coming out of a 50 ohm resistor at room temperature, 290 degrees Kelvin, is very close to minus 114 dBm per megasecond. The laws of physics tell you that the random motion of the electrons in your 50 ohm dummy load generates a predictable amount of noise. I mean, everything above absolute zero has molecules running around shaking in place or actually moving, if you know what I mean. And so the amount of thermal noise is a function of how hot that 50 ohm generator is. You can then put a heater on that 50 ohm generator and increase its temperature and it will make a predictable amount of noise power increase. So you've got something traceable to the Bureau. Minus 114 dBm per megacycle at room temperature. And you can keep referring back to that with your Dickey switch and notice to calibrate what is the noise power coming out of your noise source. That make a little bit more sense, Bill. WQGZ, K2IW.
Let me add something to that, too.
You got it, Andy.
The noise sources that I have, in reference to the calibration, there's a factor called excessive noise. And I know that in the specification sheet on the noise sources that I have, and they're brand new, by the way, they give you that excessive noise number, and you use that to calibrate the noise figure meter as a reference point, and that's where you start, from the excessive noise that the noise generator, the noise source will generate. Make sense?
Yeah, I'm going to add to that one. The best possible noise generator would be completely flat. If you set it for key excess, that's the word that Andy was mentioned, excess noise power, TXX is called, how much hotter it is, so to speak, than a 50 ohm resistor at room temperature, with a correction factor. If the noise generator was perfect, it would be flat. If you set it for 16 dB of TXS, it would generate exactly that amount from DC to light. Well, every noise generator has some minor wiggle to it. So when it's properly calibrated, there usually is a chart on the side of the noise generator. Usually it's a bunch of pinpricks on a graph telling you it's 16.0 at this frequency, it's 16.1 at that frequency, it's 16.2 at that frequency. So knowing the exact calibrated, measured noise power density, the TXS of your noise generator at each of its frequencies, depending on what frequency region you're using it, you pick that off the chart, and now that allows you to do a minor change in the way you set the gain of the receiver system of the automatic noise figure indicator. The way of calibrating it, you tell the automatic noise figure indicator, I'm using the TXS of 16.2, and then you do a balancing operation to adjust it so that it gives you the right answers from that particular noise source at that particular frequency region. We're getting down to the nitty-gritty here now, Bill, where we're trying to get accuracy of tenths of a dB. The people who use noise figure measurement instrumentation day in and day out tell you that when anybody claims accuracy of an absolute noise figure of better than 5/10 of a dB, you've got to be a little bit skeptical unless they're extremely careful. W2QGZ, K2IW in the TechNet.
At half a dB, and listen, getting in that vicinity would be kind of cool. So, all right, good. We have a lot to go with tonight, and more to follow. So I'll get with Andy, and we'll report back with how the next revision goes. How's that?
Sounds good, Bill. Let me give you one little piece of warning. A radiometry system, in other words, the kind of electronics that's used in a radio telescope, which is intended to measure extremely weak noise signals coming from stars that are billions of light years away. That technique is extremely vulnerable to weak excess signals. So when you're using an automatic noise figure indicator, let's assume that it boils down to a 60 megacycle IF of the system. If any extraneous signal in the environment will go through the mixer as an M by M product, and come out at 60 megacycles within the IF, you could have an extremely weak signal generator a mile away from your automatic noise figure indicator, and it can disturb the accuracy something fierce. In fact, an awful lot of people using an automatic noise figure indicator will do it inside of a screen room. A local cell site could give you quite a bit of grief. Now, that's going to change the absolute number. It's not going to change the way you do the peaking of your preamplifier. You're still going to peak the preamplifier for the best noise figure. But if you measure what you think is 5/10 of a dB of noise figure, and somebody turns on an extraneous signal that gets into this radiometry system, which is so vulnerable to weak signals, and disturbs it, you may get an indication of 1.5 dB noise figure when the real noise figure is 0.5. So you got to worry about extraneous signals. Back to you for any comments on that one, Bill. QGZ, KQLIW.
Okay, makes sense. No, we're in good shape. So, 1,000 thank yous and more to follow from WB.